Hello, I'm Mary Willett. I'll be your presenter today for part three of Fundamentals of Compliance and Ethics. This is the Retirement Plan Administrator Series fourth course, and it provides three 90-minute webinars for each course. Today, we are going to cover the last section of the Compliance and Ethics course, which is designed for any party that has a role in the retirement programs of public sector employers, particularly those who have a fiduciary responsibility to the plan. The purpose of this course, as well as the other three courses that INFRE has provided in regard to the Retirement Plan Administrator Series, is to make sure that all those parties that have a role in the plan have a basic understanding of what is required to ensure the retirement plans comply with governing federal tax laws, as well as the responsibilities of each party within the plan. This course, in addition to governing federal tax law compliance, it also discusses ethics and the principles that should govern plan administrators, board or committee members, as well as other fiduciaries. So this course, the first two webinars that we had on this course included the introduction to governmental regulation. We talked about the fiduciary role and responsibilities, compliance in form, compliance in operation, and then the IRS corrective programs that are available if there are issues with the program administration or if there are defects within the program itself, the design of the program itself. This webinar will cover the reporting aspects, what's required in regard to reporting requirements for retirement benefits in public sector plans. We'll talk about the role of independent professionals, as well as ethics for retirement plan administrators. So the textbook chapters that we're covering is 6, 7, and 8. So let's move right into our discussion of those chapters, and we'll begin with reporting requirements. One thing to keep in mind, for public sector plans, the reporting requirements are significantly different than they are for private sector plans. Private sector plans have specific requirements that are found in ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, that requires reporting to be made by plan sponsors of private sector plans directly to the Department of Labor, as well as specific reports that must be provided to participants. Although public sector plans are not mandated or required to provide the same type of reports, often similar reports are produced to ensure fiduciaries meet their responsibility to the plan, and participants receive specific information about that benefit, and it's considered, as far as what's required by the Department of Labor for private sector plans, particularly in regard to participant disclosures, those requirements that are identified by the Department of Labor are typically considered best practice guidance for fiduciaries of public sector plans. So let's begin with financial reporting requirements. In the public sector, again, financial reports, financial statements are not absolutely required. Generally, however, plans will conduct financial statements or produce financial statements for their plans to ensure that they, again, are meeting their fiduciary responsibilities to the program and its participants. Financial statements produced in the public sector generally will follow the governmental accounting standards board's requirements. They establish guidelines for financial statements, and as a rule, public sector plans will try to follow those guidelines as much as possible. They're not considered mandatory, but there are specific reasons why public entities will want to follow those established guidelines. In the private sector, guidelines or rules for financial statements are established the Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB. The requirements for private sector plans, however, are not optional. They're required, so they must follow those rules. One reason why public sector plans should strongly consider following the guidelines that are established by GASB is that the failure to comply with those standards, not completing financial statements in the manner that has been established by GASB, could actually have an indirect effect on the any bond issuance of that entity or the ratings that that entity would receive on their bonds. In regard to the different types of plans, retirement plans that are out there, defined benefit plans, defined contribution plans, we're using as the general categories of plans. And defined benefit plans, in a financial, the financial statement for a defined benefit plan is going to define what actually is the state of that pension plan, and it will identify the assets that they have available for paying current and future benefits. In addition, the defined benefit plan financial statements will identify the funding obligations that that employer has, how well they're meeting those obligations, in providing sufficient contributions and investment earnings to meet the future, the current and future benefit payments that they have for that plan. And the financial statements themselves will be used by the actuary in making future funding assumptions for that plan. For defined contribution plans, the financial statements are a little different. And in this category of defined contribution plans, we're talking about plans that have actual identified accounts for each participant, and the financial statements that are prepared by the employer, by the plan sponsor, are going to ensure that the actual participant statements, the statements that are submitted to, distributed to participants and beneficiaries, are complete and accurate to reflect their actual statement of account. So the plan financial statements have a tremendous purpose in confirming the accuracy of the assets, where they're held, and how they're accounted for by the plan, by the administrator of that plan, to ensure that participants and beneficiaries can receive an accurate statement of account. The various components of a financial statement, and I'm just going to go through four different components of financial statements for this course. There's more information in the textbook, and as I've said throughout the webinars, what we're providing here provides the top level, and the details are actually in the textbook that you're provided to go along with this course. So the financial statement components, first the statement of plan net assets, that statement, separate portion of the financial statement itself will identify and show the specific assets and liabilities on a given date. So if you have a calendar year financial statement or a fiscal year statement, whatever you're using on that specific date, your financial statement will show the actual amount of assets and the liabilities for that plan. The statement of changes in plan net assets shows what actually has been contributed and what has been paid out for a specific period. So if it's an annual financial statement, anything that has been contributed during the plan to the plan during that year, or 12-month period, if it's a fiscal year, during that 12-month period will be identified on the statement of changes in plan net assets, as well as any amounts that have been paid out. So inflow and outflow. The outflow could include, in addition to benefit payments to participants, any expenses that have been paid from the plan assets themselves. The third component of a financial statement is the schedule of funding progress. Particularly for a defined benefit plan, this is going to show the unfunded actuarial accrued liability, both as actual dollars as well as a percentage of current payroll for the current and past 5 years. Again, this is important for the actuaries when they are making their assumptions on the plan funding and future contributions. The schedule of employer contributions is the fourth component of the financial statement, and that shows the actual annual required contribution that the employer was scheduled to make, and how much the employer actually contributed to the plan. So this will help in determining how well the employer is funding the program. And within the private sector, there are specific requirements as to how that funding must be handled. In the public sector, the funding requirements are not applicable. Additional reports that are going to become a necessary part of your plan, whether it's a requirement or not. But as a fiduciary, you're going to need to understand and develop investment performance reports. For defined benefit plans, that report is going to monitor the specific investment of the trust assets. The purpose for that investment performance report is going to be to identify how well those investment managers, the people that are actually investing the assets of the plan, are complying with the established investment policy statement for that program, and as well as are they meeting their benchmarks, their performance benchmarks, as well as what is the cost of those transactions that they're actually using in order to invest trust assets, and how is that impacting the performance of the trust. In a defined contribution plan, the investment performance report is going to monitor the actual investment options that are offered to participants to make their own selection on how to invest their retirement assets. It's important from a fiduciary standpoint to ensure that the investment products, the investment options that you put into your plan continue to be appropriate for individuals' long-term retirement investment, both in regard to performance as well as cost. The investment performance report is also going to allow the employer or the plan sponsor to confirm that the investment options that are put into the plan remain consistent with the established investment policy statement as well. The investment policy statement for a defined benefit plan and defined contribution plan will be different, but both should have a specific policy that's been developed and shared with any of the investment managers or the investment companies that are part of the plan. Additional reports for plan compliance includes a plan statistics report and a contract compliance report. Plan statistics reports are specifically helpful in defined benefit plans, again, to help the actuary understand the demographic profile of the participant base, to be able to determine the age of retirees and just to make some assumption as to how much will be paid out over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years and how well funded the plan is. So the trends in service and income and age of the population that is part of that program is critical for actuaries, and the statistics report will provide the valuable information to the actuaries in developing information on funding and their actuarial assumptions. In a defined contribution plan, plan statistics reports are going to be valuable in helping the plan sponsor better understand what education and communication needs might be required to be addressed going forward. Participant demographics, the age of the individual participants, maybe what their deferral levels are, how well they're diversifying their portfolio, are they increasing deferrals, are they transferring assets when their plan or rebalancing their assets periodically, what type of distributions are being selected by retirees. All that information in the plan statistics report will help the employer better understand and the plan sponsor better understand future needs in regard to education and communication, as well as potential changes that may be needed in the plan design. So plan statistics report, again, this is not a mandatory report in the public or private sector, but it is definitely something that fiduciaries need to consider in order to make sure their plan is administered appropriately and your participants are being serviced adequately. The contract compliance report is another report. Again, it's not mandatory, it's not required, but as a fiduciary, in order to meet your responsibility to the plan and ensure you're not at risk as a fiduciary for failure to meet your fiduciary requirements, the contract compliance report is important to monitor any outsourced providers that you are using in your plan to ensure that they are meeting the contractual requirements that you've established, the performance standards that are in the contracts. Hopefully you've gotten all of those documented and you're getting periodic reports on that, but the contract compliance report will help you determine that they are meeting the requirements of the contract as well as they're meeting the requirements of federal and state laws, perhaps. That could be also part of that contract compliance report. In regard to the types of reports that and information that is submitted to participants, again, there are no requirements in the public sector that these documents, these disclosures be provided, but they are a mandatory feature in private sector plans. And the first is a summary plan description, or SPD. Under ERISA, this is a requirement, and there are specific timelines as to when the SPD document must be presented to employees and participants, and it must be prepared in easily understood language, and it also must be provided in alternate language if a significant portion of the workforce is has another language for their primary language. So if you have 25% of your employee population that is Spanish-speaking, you would have to then provide this summary plan description in Spanish as well as English. The type of information that's provided in the summary plan description is detailed in under Department of Labor rules. In general, the key information that must be included is the eligibility requirements, the description of the benefits and how they are accruing, with the type, how they earn those benefits, as well as how do they go about claiming benefits. So that's just in a nutshell, that's the three broad categories of information that's included in a summary plan description. Again, Department of Labor rules specifies the actual information that must be included. Another document that is required in the public sector and the private sector under ERISA is a summary of material modification, or an SMM. This document is prepared and distributed anytime there are changes to the plan or material modifications that have been made in the plan document itself, and that must be prepared and distributed to participants within a specified time frame. This is particularly important, and it is specifically required when there are changes that are made to a plan to comply with amendments or changes to governing laws or regulations. So the summary of material modification will explain and describe the changes that have occurred to the plan, and an explanation of how that impacts this benefit and to the worker, to the participant. Another mandatory requirement for private sector is to distribute participant benefit statements. Generally, public sector the plans are also going to provide a benefit statement, whether it's a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan. In the private sector, participant-directed defined contribution plans must provide quarterly participant statements to their membership. If it is not a participant-directed defined contribution plan, the statement is required annually, and for defined benefit plans, statements are required at least once every 3 years. In addition, for defined benefit plans, they've got to be available by request. So those are the requirements under ERISA as to the frequency of statements. The actual content of the statement is going to vary by plan type. And there are discussions right now in legislators and the regulatory environment as well as the legislative environment that could potentially require defined contribution plans to provide additional information on the statement than what's required now. And that additional information is an illustration of lifetime income based on accumulated assets. This isn't a requirement today in the private sector, but it is something that as a public sector plan sponsor you need to be aware of, because it is an important additional information that will help participants understand the retirement benefit they're being provided in a defined contribution environment. The reason why this is becoming an issue is that just having $50,000 in an account balance an individual cannot translate easily to understand what that means for an income level in a defined benefit plan, then you get an estimate of what your monthly benefit will be on those annual statements. And that's not something that is provided on a defined contribution plan today. All we're showing is actual asset accumulation and the value of their assets at a given day. So under ERISA, in a participant-directed defined contribution plan, there are specific information that must be provided on the statement that includes what the value is of each asset, each of the investments they have, and they have a balance. So if an individual has five investment options, they would show their accumulated assets by each of those investment options. They also need to provide in the statement an explanation of any limitation or restriction that's imposed on investments. One example is the equity wash. A lot of fixed options, stable value fund in particular, have a requirement that you cannot move assets directly from a stable value fund to another similar fund, another bond or fixed option. It first has to go to an equity fund, and then after 90 days, then they could move it back into a fixed option. So any type of limitation, or if there's a cost involved with a transfer, any type of restriction at all would need to be included in the quarterly statements that are provided to participants. The third item that must be included on the participant statements or within the statement package is an explanation of the importance of diversification, why having a well-balanced, diversified portfolio can provide them with a better option for their retirement security. It also must include a link or direction as to how participants can get additional information from the Department of Labor website at www.dol.gov. So those are just, again, very broad, but the Department of Labor has specific information that the statement must include. In addition to that, they also must include information about the fees and costs for participating in the plan. There's a lot of more recent rules from the Department of Labor on the dissemination and the disclosure of participant fees and costs and how those costs should be provided, whether it is on the quarterly statement or in other material. And we did talk about that in earlier webinars. Another participant disclosure that must be provided, and this is something that applies to public and private sector plans, and that also includes deferred compensation plans under 457B of governmental employers, and that is the 402F notice. The 402F notice is something that will inform participants and beneficiaries of their rights to elect direct rollovers of their distributions. So if they're getting a distribution from their account, this notice must be provided between 30 and 180 days of the lump sum distribution, and the notice must be very specific into their rights on rolling assets, as well as the mandatory 20% withholding rules if it is not rolled over. The Internal Revenue Service provides two model 402F notices. Most plans will follow those verbatim. And just provide the notice that has been drafted by the Internal Revenue Service to ensure that they are complying with the requirements of the regulation, and why reinvent the wheel. If you've got the IRS providing the model notice, there's no reason not to just use those models. Additional disclosures that are made to participants and that are required by under ERISA for private sector plans, usually state and local laws in regard to these are going to govern anything within the public sector, state and local plan, local government retirement plans. But it has to do with options, distribution options for participants with a spouse. And the qualified joint survivor annuity and the explanations of this it's a lifetime benefit paid over the lives of a participant and surviving spouse. There are specific requirements in regard to how the distribution should continue to the surviving spouse. It can be 100% to the spouse, 50% or 75%. But those explanations need to give specific details as to what the qualified joint survivor annuity is and what their requirements are in regard to selecting a distribution option or providing a waiver if they do not want a joint survivor if for the married participant. The qualified pre-retirement survivor annuity is something that's paid to the surviving spouse if the participant has died before distribution but after they have vested. So they own the benefit, they vested in the benefit, but they have died before they've begun distribution. And there are specific requirements as to the fact that the survivor then would receive the vested portion of that benefit. And so that there's an explanation that is required on that pre-retirement survivor annuity benefit as well. Within the public sector, we have additional rules in regard to documentation and open records laws. Open records laws generally are going to apply to public sector plans, whether they be state or local governments, and the type of information that must be provided to the public at request is going to differ based on the state laws, the laws that are in place for that entity. But generally, it's going to include the plan document, trust agreements, your summary plan description, if you have one, participant statement, contracts, and if you have an IRS determination letter, that also is generally going to be part of your open records. There is, with technology advancements, there are more and more of the documentation and the reports that particularly that go to participants that are being created electronically. The Internal Revenue Service, under IRC regulations, there are rules as to how you can go about providing anything that is required to be provided electronically. And there's also Department of Labor rules that have been established that govern private sector plans under ERISA in regard to reporting and requirements. But generally under the IRS, that any type of electronic disclosures and electronic reporting must be reasonably designed and in a manner that is just as easy to understand as it is if it's provided in paper. So you can't have something that's more complicated if it's an electronic version than it would be if it was a paper form. Also, you must, if you're providing a document electronically, you have to provide the ability for that individual to retain or reproduce that document for later. So if they want to print out that, if you're sending the participant statements electronically, you are going to be required to provide that individual with the ability to print that statement or store it somehow in a file electronically so that they can use it at a later date. Generally, under the Internal Revenue Service, their requirements also dictate that you must be provided prior consent from the participant to provide only electronic reports and disclosures. So in other words, you need to get a written authorization from participants saying, yes, I want to receive my documentation electronically. In the absence of that, you must provide them paper forms, paper versions. Department of Labor, they have specific rules and a little more procedures that an employer could follow in addition to safe harbor rules that if they are providing electronic documents that meet specific requirements that the Department of Labor set out, that's acceptable. Two ways that they could do it: they could provide electronic delivery through work emails without a prior consent. So if they're getting those documents at their work site and the employer or the plan sponsor knows that they've received them, that's okay. Or if they've received prior consent from the recipients, from the from the participants or beneficiaries. That's also a safe harbor rule. The Department of Labor actually requires that the any electronic delivery of these documents must be able to be verified that the individual has received them. The system that distributes this information must also protect confidentiality. So there's got to be a sufficient system in place that will demonstrate that this information is maintained confidentially. There is some interest, again, in legislative and regulatory bodies that would reduce the amount of hoops that an employer has to jump through in order to provide electronic distribution of these documents, and it would be basically what they're basically saying in some of the proposals is that participants would automatically be able to be provided electronic documents unless they opt out of that. So instead of having to receive prior consent to distribute electronic documents, the participant would have to provide consent directly to the plan sponsor that they don't want them electronically. So they're trying to make it easier, recognizing that there's cost savings involved in producing the documentation, particularly in the private sector side where there is so much documentation that must be provided, that they are recognizing that the cost can be reduced if these documents can be distributed electronically. One thing that why reporting is important, particularly in the private and the public sector, since we are not mandated by this, is that reports can actually demonstrate the fiduciary responsibilities are being met. For instance, an annual report. You can prepare an annual report that captures all required notices, any reports that can be maintained and retained. To demonstrate that you are meeting your fiduciary responsibilities to the plan in regard to monitoring and ensuring the plan is administered appropriately. Again, even though public sector is not mandated by many of these requirements, they generally will consider them as best practice. And in addition, any type of documentation, the participant statements, the reports that you submit to participants can actually help demonstrate how valuable this benefit is to the employee's future. Okay, the next chapter, Chapter 7, the role of independent professionals in a plan. There are many people that have a role in the retirement plan, and this chapter goes through the different types of occupations, the professions that may be part of a defined benefit or defined contribution plan. The type of professionals that will be part of your plan are going to be dictated by the type of plan. Defined benefit plans, for example, have actuarial services that are a requirement. Defined contribution plan, participant directed, there are none. And it is important for you to understand all of the different parties and the standards that maybe you want to seek when you hire someone or when you outsource a certain service for the plan. And it's important that anybody that has a role with a program, whether they're in-house or they are outsourced providers, has a comprehensive understanding of the plan and is given adequate information to be able to understand their specific roles and responsibilities and what is required of them. First, let's go through the attorney services that may be required for your program. Generally, an attorney is going to be instrumental, if not the only party that has a role in drafting the plan document. They're not going to do it in isolation, of course. They're going to work with the plan administrator. They're going to work with the plan sponsor in determining what is necessary, what features of the program should be included in the plan document, particularly if there is some optional features that the employer can select to put in the plan itself. But the attorney may be necessary to ensure that the plan document is drafted according to the Internal Revenue Service and Private Sector Plans Department of Labor rules that apply. If there is an instance where the plan itself is being audited, or is you're submitting a request for a determination letter to the Internal Revenue Service, generally you will need to have an attorney represent you and help negotiate or discuss what is required if there is particularly if it was an audit or a employee plan compliance resolution system issue that you're working through with the Internal Revenue Service. You're going to have an attorney that works with you to help negotiate or identify solutions. An attorney may also be needed to help you evaluate the legitimacy of QDROs, Qualified Domestic Relations Orders. They may not be needed to look at all of them, but there may be a need for you to have an attorney help you if you have a difficult or complicated order that has been provided to you from the court to secure a QDRO. An attorney also may be necessary to help you identify and interpret changes in federal laws and regulations, as well as any state laws or rules that are put in place and how it impacts your plan. Accountants are another profession that you will generally have need for in a retirement plan. It could be a certified public accountant. There are specific, in the private sector, there are specific qualifications that are needed for like submitting the Form 5500, which is part of the financial reporting that's needed, and a CPA is required for completing that Form 5500. Public sector don't have that type of requirement, but you're generally going to want to have someone with that professional qualification in helping you prepare your financial statements. If there's going to be an audit, you're going to want general tax consulting on perhaps if there's a delinquent fee that you must provide to the IRS. So a CPA is somebody that's going to be a vital part, have a vital role in your retirement plan as well. Audits may be a part of the accountant's role as well. It may be somebody that is doing it in-house, or you may contract out. You may have an independent auditor that is providing an audit of your program. ERISA offers the best practices to follow in regard to auditors and the specific qualifications that they require that you would want to consider in the private sector. Also, you're going to need to review your state laws to see if there are any dictates as to the type of individuals that you would need to have audit your plan, whether it be an accountant or have some other additional professional certifications for auditors. And then any errors or defects that's been identified in an audit by the accountant or the individual that's been preparing your audit. We talked about the Employee Plans Compliance Resolution System, the EPCRS, at the last webinar, and talked about the different ways that errors can be corrected, defects can be corrected in your plan. Actuaries, they're specific actuarial needs for all of the various employee benefits. Retirement benefits is one specialized service that actuaries provide, but there are also life insurance programs, health insurance programs, disability insurance programs, and they all have specialized actuarial services that may be handled by one or more actuarial firms. Generally, these are going to be outsourced, but in regard to the defined benefit plan, the actuaries are going to provide you with evaluation of your pension plan, and they also will provide the future contributions that are needed to fund the program today and in the futures. Generally, actuaries that are used by the public sector employers are going to hold one or more actuarial credentials. In the private sector, there are specific requirements in regard to the type of actuary that must be used for defined benefit plans. Enrolled actuary is a term you may be familiar with. The textbook explains that term as well as the different certifications that you may see that actuaries have. The Society of Actuary has different certifications as well. Investment professionals within the retirement program. Again, they're going to depend on if it's a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan and the type of role that they have within your plan. You're going to hear the differences between the registered investment advisor and a registered representative. An RIA is licensed by the state or the Security and Exchange Commission, and they are licensed to provide specific advice. They also can be considered a co-fiduciary for a trustee plan. So if it's a defined benefit plan, you can use an RIA as a co-trustee or a co-fiduciary for the investment of the trust assets. A registered representative is a broker-dealer. They're licensed to buy and sell securities on behalf of a client. If they are going to offer investment advice, however, they also must be a registered investment advisor or an RIA. Next is an investment consultant, and this is, again, the type of individual that would be your investment consultant, whether it be an RIA or an RR, is registered investment advisor or a registered representative, will be determined by what it is that you want that investment consultant to do. They have various and assorted roles and responsibilities. They may not be either an RIA or an RR. But generally, an investment consultant is going to help you develop your investment policy statement. They may help you select and monitor investments. They may be the individual or the company that you hire or you seek services from to provide educational services to your participants about investments. They also might provide investment guidance or advice. If they are providing guidance, they do not have to be an RIA or an RR. If they are providing advice, they would have to be a registered investment advisor. You may want them to be one or the other or both to provide that investment guidance, but it's not a requirement. Conducting enrollment meetings and investments workshops might be another role that you hire an investment consultant to provide. Again, if they're not providing advice, they do not have to have that designation as a registered investment advisor. An investment manager. Investment manager is somebody that is actually investing the assets of the trust, or an investment manager of a mutual fund, maybe the person responsible for investing the assets in a mutual fund or some specific investment option within your defined contribution plan investment menu. They generally will be a registered investment advisor. They are actively engaged in buying, selling, and selling investments of a portfolio or a fund. And the guidelines that you have for these investment managers, what they must follow, what restrictions or requirements they have on the type of investments that they buy or sell, that's going to be identified and put in your investment policy statement. The plan administrator. The plan administrator is an all-encompassing term. That individual is who is ultimately responsible for the day-to-day operation of the plan and to ensure that the plan is designed and administered according to federal and state laws. There may be a person, it may be multiple people within the plan sponsor, it may be a group, it may be assigned to a board or committee, or that role actually may be contracted out. There is no absolute single way that the plan administrator's role could be handled. But the role of a plan administrator generally will include being responsible for whether they make the final decisions or not, but they may have responsibility for hiring professionals and managing contracts, whether that's directly or indirectly. They may make recommendations to a board or committee that actually will be responsible for the final decisions on hiring professionals, hiring the people that will be part of the program itself, establishing policies and procedures. Another function of a plan administrator's role, approving or denying benefit claims, managing distribution of benefits, preparing participant statements, developing and preparing fiduciary reports and communication. Generally, all of these items that I just talked about in regard to the role of the plan administrator makes that individual or whoever is in that role a fiduciary to the plan. A third-party administrator, or TPA, is another professional a profession within a retirement program, generally that TPA is part of a defined contribution plan with participant-directed accounts, and it would be a contracted-out situation where you're contracting with a third-party administrator to provide administrative services to the program. Generally, that's going to be administrative functions where it's they're applying rules, they're calculating and benefits and processing claims. They may actually be preparing communications, keeping records, preparing participant statements, as well as any reports that are associated with the services that they're responsible for. The types of responsibilities, depending on their actual role, may not make them a fiduciary. This function may clearly may simply be following the rules and procedures and policies that has been established by the plan administrator or a board, and that following those rules and procedures would not make them a fiduciary. There may be specific requirements for the retirement plan, particularly in the public sector, in regard to auditing functions and how audits would be handled. Government audits include Internal Revenue Service audits, and those audits that are conducted by the Internal Revenue Service, whether they be on a defined benefit plan, a defined contribution plan, or a supplemental 403B or 457 plan. There's various ways that they can be triggered, why that plan would be audited. It could be a random selection. Periodically, the IRS audit area will say that we're auditing 403B plans, and they did that not that long ago, and they selected plans, a random selection of plans that they would then go out and perform audits. An IRS audit also could be triggered by complaints from either an individual or a group, participants complaining to the IRS, and perhaps there's a trend that they see with participants complaining. 457 plan, for instance, the hardship withdrawals aren't being administered consistently. Some people are getting withdrawals under a hardship situation and others are not. Complaints from an individual or group could trigger an IRS audit. If there is information that is garnered from another unrelated audit or another review that the IRS is conducting, say that they're looking at a life insurance program that the employer is administering for that a different benefit, and something triggers them to say, we also need to audit the retirement plan. So there's information generated from other sources that might cause the IRS to say we need to take a more thorough look of that retirement benefit as well. Other types of audits are compliance audits that the employer institutes or the plan sponsor institutes to ensure that their plan complies with the Internal Revenue Code. They could hire a separate independent auditor to come in and do, in addition to the contract compliance audits, to actually incorporate a review of Internal Revenue Code requirements and how well that they're meeting those requirements. For example, benefit and contribution limits. If you are outsourcing that, or even if you're doing it in-house, how well are you complying with those benefit and contribution limits? It's much better to evaluate that and audit it internally first so that you don't have an issue with an IRS audit later. Within the public sector, there may be additional requirements that are put in place through state statutes or through the state auditors or similar government entity that requires an independent audit or maybe even has individuals a certain area of that government that will come in and audit your program. One of the important things to understand when you're outsourcing or in regard to all the professionals that make up your plan is who is a fiduciary and who's not, and ensuring that the structure and administration of the plan is scrutinized in regard to, are we meeting the fiduciary rules, the requirements to the plan and its participants. One way to ensure that your fiduciaries are meeting their responsibilities is to educate them. It's up to the plan administrator, generally, to ensure fiduciaries have sufficient education and training to ensure that they are meeting their duties to participants and beneficiaries. And we've got down here in the final bullet on this slide is educated fiduciaries equal a well-managed plan. That can't be stressed enough. Saying I didn't know that was a requirement of me is not a justifiable reason for you not to meet your duties to the plan. If anything, saying I didn't know that was required of me sets up red flags and says you aren't meeting your duties to the plan because it's your responsibility to make sure you know it. And it's the plan administrator's role to make sure that anyone that has a fiduciary responsibility, whether they are in-house individuals or outsourced professionals, that they understand what their requirements are and if they have a fiduciary role and making sure that they are meeting any requirements as a fiduciary to their plan. Okay, we have our last chapter of this course to go through is the ethics for retirement administrators. We do have some case studies at the end of that course material, at the end of Chapter 8, that we won't be specifically going through in the webinar. I'll talk about them briefly, but I do encourage you to take some time, work through those case studies on your own, even work with individuals within your, you know, your peers at your employment to help you go through those case studies just so that you can learn from each other as to what is ethically required and how you should handle certain ethical situations. So as an overview, ethical decisions are something that's not always clear. It could go either way, but there may be a better way to do it, but let's talk it through. Ethics goes beyond what is legal to determine what is right. So it may be gray. You know, it may help one person or it may help many people. What should we do? Ethics is going to help you make those types of decisions. The workplace, the environment that you have within an organization, as well as the leadership that is part of your organization can have the most influence, can have a very positive or negative influence on the ethical decisions that are being made. And INFRI has developed a code of ethics to help professionals within this industry identify acceptable ethical behavior and what should be done in absence of any legal responsibilities or duties that they may have. So ethics is a system of moral principles, and it deals with what's right versus what's wrong based on the profession's rules of conduct. And as I said, ethical situations, the answer's not always clear. It's going to be more gray than it is black and white. So when you're looking at how you make ethical decisions, are you going to make one decision if somebody's looking or you think somebody's going to be aware of what you're doing versus what kind of decision you're making when you think no one will know or no one will have it, no one's looking? Do you know what you actually have a right to do versus what is the right thing to do? You have a right to make a decision that goes one way versus another way. It's totally up to you. But what is the right thing to do? And the ethics that the profession has established, as well as what we're going to go through here, can help you make those decisions. Again, ethics is what is your personal responsibility that goes beyond what the law says that you have to do. The law may be silent on specific issues, but it's up to you to determine which is the right way to go. Again, ethics goes beyond legal rules. Conflicts of interest are good examples of dilemmas that are not governed by law. And I'm not talking about conflicts, fiduciary conflicts of interest. That's different. But maybe it's just, you know, somebody that is coming to you for information on their mother's benefits, and they're a friend of yours. And you're looking at the situation from a friend perspective instead of a professional perspective. You know, the mother or the actual participant may be sick, and the friend of yours that is a daughter, maybe the daughter is coming to you for information, and you know that what they're doing isn't something that's going to harm their participant, but are you ethically allowed to give out information that is on the participant, even though, you know, it's a family member and not the participant itself? So that's a type of conflicts of interest that we're referencing here. Again, the INFRI Code of Ethics was established to help you and provide guidance as to what is acceptable behavior for this profession. So when you're looking at making an ethical decision, so you have internal motivators and external motivators. Internal motivators are what you feel yourself. If I do something this way, I won't be able to sleep with myself at night because I was brought up differently than that. I can't do it that way. Or whatever values that you have within yourself is your internal motivators. And that has a tremendous impact on these ethical decisions. In addition to those, though, are your external motivators, and that's your environment. The workplace that you are within, that is that your workplace, your immediate supervisors, your management, how they actually view those decisions. If they made a bad ethical choice and you've seen them do that, are they leading by example? And should you, maybe you'll make a bad ethical choice as well. So that external motivator has, I'm not going to say equal, it depends on your internal motivators, but it can have even more influence perhaps than your internal motivators. So there's different approaches that you can take to each ethical situation. And there's four that we're going to go through. Conventional approach compares your actions to what is considered the prevailing norm. Everybody else is doing it, so why not me? Everybody's driving 55 or 65 on a highway when the speed limit's 50. Why shouldn't I just go along with the crowd? Everyone is taking office supplies. Those pens that say the state of Wisconsin, since I'm in Wisconsin, why not just take a couple of pens for my kids? They've got homework they've got to do, and everybody else is doing it, so I'll just take them. That is the conventional approach. Utilitarianism approach considers what is the best for the greatest number of people to determine what's ethically sound. Consider Robin Hood. Robin Hood stole from the rich to give to the poor. Maybe there was one or two people here that they were taking money from. They're not going to miss it. But what we're doing is feeding 12 people, or we're feeding 200 people. So we're not going to harm. We may harm one or two people, but we are going to benefit 100. Another example is airport security. When they started making you take off your shoes and sending your luggage through the x-ray machines, for the greater good, it may be harming one person or it may be harming you individually, but for the masses, this is a utilitarianism approach because it's the greatest good for the greatest number. We're going to protect everyone. Principle of rights is the opposite of that. It considers an individual's priority. For the airport example, I'm not going to take my shoes off. The principle of rights is my rights outweigh the rights of the masses, and that considers only one's duty or obligation to an individual. Regardless of the consequences, my moral principles are going to dictate, on honesty, fairness, loyalty, trustworthiness, and the respect for others. Those moral principles are going to guide your decisions regardless of the consequences. Another approach to determining making your ethical decisions is the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's considered the natural law. Everybody's heard of it. When they're growing up, who hasn't heard that, that said to them many times? Would you want somebody to do that to you? And describing a behavior that may not have been the best as a child. The platinum rule, however, goes further than that. It says to do unto others as they would have you do unto them, meaning put yourself in the other person's shoes and think about how they would want you, what decision they would want you to make, or what action they would want you to take. Instead of what you would want them to do to you, what they would want you to do to them. And that's the platinum rule. Earlier I talked about the influence of the workplace can be critical in helping establish an ethical environment. Looking at what the organization does as a whole in regard to respecting authority, committing to group success, do they recognize and reward good outcomes, good ethical decisions, and team players? Do they reject the pressure for bottom line results? Example for that is call center. Almost every area, every plan is going to have a call center, and they're going to set up statistics and data that they're collecting on number of calls, length of calls, and how many people they service in an hour, or how many actually provide service in an hour. Does the entity, does your organization value numbers more than they value quality? If the individual employee says, but they are asking questions and I couldn't stop answering their questions, they needed them answered, I couldn't make my quota of 10 calls an hour or 20 calls an hour. I needed to take time and recognize that those individuals that are calling me have a right to the answers. So does your organization recognize that, or do they penalize you because the individuals are taking more time than are necessary on those calls? Does the organization penalize messengers of bad news? How many of you have had a supervisor or somebody that you work with say, don't bring that information to me unless you've got a solution? I don't want to hear bad news. Just gloss, you know, I just keep it to yourself or go away, take it somewhere else. I don't want to hear it. That doesn't create an ethical environment. Bad news is, you have to know the bad news to fix it. And then the final one is, does your organization conform to expectations of behavior? So is there expectations of good behavior? Is there expectations of ethical behavior? Or is there no expectations? Studies show that when it comes to dealing with the ethical dilemmas at work, the most influential factor in making those is how your immediate supervisor, deals with ethics on their own. So behavior of the immediate supervisor is actually demonstrated in studies that have shown that they have the most impact on everyone else's ethical decision making or actions that they take in regard to following good ethics. So as a result of that, if you are in a leadership role within an organization, you have a responsibility to set the tone by setting an example, rewarding ethical behavior, and discouraging unethical behaviors. Sounds easy, but you know that's something that needs to take is takes work, and it takes recognizing that it is the leadership's responsibility to take on that role. Okay, so when we're looking at INFRI's code of ethics, the ethics that have been established by INFRI address situations that retirement counselors, administrators, and other financial professionals within a retirement plan environment are likely to face in their professional role. It also affirms the increased importance of retirement administration planning, education, and counseling and advice today. Retirement has never been more important in regard, these plans have never been more important, particularly as in the private sector, more going away from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, there's more options in regard to failure in meeting participants' needs in retirement, if they're not investing appropriately, if they're not investing enough, if they're not getting into the program soon enough. You know, the types of situations that arise in a defined contribution plan may be a little different and more frequent than in a defined benefit plan. Okay, so let's go through quickly the principles that INFRI has set forth in regard to ethics. What are the ethical principles that they've established? Number one is to comply with the letter and spirit of all federal and state laws that pertain to that retirement plan that regulate advice, services, records, transactions, or just the plan administration. This is important that not only are you complying with, and that's what this is stating, not just the absolute, what the language of the law says, but what is the spirit of that law? Why was that law established? One thing that you can take in regard to that is an example of that is participant fee disclosures. In the private sector, that is a mandatory law. In the public sector, we don't have that. It's not a mandatory requirement that participants receive all of the information that's necessary on fees and costs. But you could argue that the spirit of the law, the spirit of the fact that the Department of Labor has said participants need this information in order to make educated decisions about their retirement investments, the spirit could dictate under our ethical principle that public sector plans should follow the same rules. Principle number two is act always in the best interest of the retirement plan participant for whom services are performed. And when performing services for a retirement plan as a whole, act in the best interest of all persons who have rights under the plan. Now, this is a fiduciary requirement, always act in the best interest of the plan and its participants. But for ethics, this takes decisions and actions that are not up to the level of a fiduciary and says you need to apply the same standard. The same standard that a fiduciary must use in meeting their requirements to the plan, even if you're not a fiduciary, even if it's not a fiduciary action, you need to apply the same principle. Principle number three, never disclose confidential information about the financial, finances, or status of a particular plan participant unless authorized by the participant or by the law. My example that I talked about earlier where an individual a representative, a counselor, has a friend that comes in and says, I want information about my mother's account, even though that mother is not there and the mother is maybe sick, our code says you can't disclose that information. Most retirement systems are going to have a rule that says you can't disclose that information as a work rule. But ethically, you also have a requirement not to disclose that information. The only situations, unless it's allowed by your plan or mandated by your plan, is in situations of a subpoena or something like that when it's required by law to disclose that information. Principle number four, be truthful and forthright in all communications relating to retirement services and transactions. Again, these are not black and white situations. So sometimes you're saying, is that really truthful or can I get away with saying it this way even though maybe it's not 100% accurate but it's going to save me time or effort if I don't provide the full facts. An example could be, somebody's calling with a question, a participant is calling with a question on an account, and they're asking a specific question, but you know that individual should also ask another question, but since they're not asking it, I don't have to answer it. So I don't need to spend that additional time. That ethics principle, that principle number four would say, yes, you do have to spend the additional time and answer questions that they may not even know they should ask. Principle number five, perform all retirement services competently, diligently, and according to the highest professional standard. Maintain the necessary specific knowledge and expertise to do so, and decline any activity that cannot be competently performed. This example of this principle is make sure that you are maintaining any educational requirements, learning what's going on that's new, staying on top of laws and regulations or any changes in the industry. But even more than that is if you don't have an answer, say I don't have an answer. So if somebody is asking you to do something for the plan that you know you don't have the expertise to do, it's your responsibility under this ethical standard to decline. If somebody is asking you a question about something specific to the plan that you don't have an answer for, based on this ethical principle, you have a responsibility to say, I don't know that, let me find out for you, or let me get somebody else to answer that. So that's what that principle is saying. Principle number six, conduct activities relating to the retirement profession under the highest standards of personal and professional integrity and in ways that reflect credibility on the profession. Meaning, handle yourself in a manner that is appropriate for your profession at all times. Principle number seven, to all persons whom services are provided by the certificate holder, disclose all sources of compensation, identify any persons or entities that pay you compensation, and any material fact about the compensation that is necessary to understand potential adverse interest, meaning conflicts of interest that you may have. If you're giving recommendations on something, and you're going to benefit from that, and you're going to say to that, you must say to that the participant that you're making a recommendation or you're making suggestions to, I'm going to get compensation based on your action. And I may get more compensation if you do X versus Y. So it's up to you under this principle to make sure that the individuals understand that and you adequately disclose that information. And the last principle is to supply material information relating to the transaction or service to the participant for whom services are performed, including information that is not requested, if such information is generally recognized as necessary to any informed decision. This is similar to the other principle when I talked about making sure that they've been provided all the information that's needed, even if they don't directly ask it. You are the experts in this profession, and individuals that come to you with for help, for services within the profession that are outside of the profession and they're coming to you, you're the one with the answers, not them. They don't necessarily know that they need to ask those additional questions, that maybe they don't know what they don't know. And it's up to you to make sure that they have the information necessary in order to make informed decisions. Okay, we have a few more minutes left in the webinar, and I just want to quickly just go through some of these case study examples just to talk briefly about them. The case studies that can be found in the textbook, and they are designed to help you understand the application of ethics in real life situations. Whether you use those or you use other situations maybe that are more germane to you and the role that you have within a retirement plan, the importance is just to talk it through with other people and get other perspectives on the ethical decisions that you're making. It's important to take time to review the specific information of each situation and how you would personally handle it. And then if others within the group that you've established might have other ideas, and you might be able to look at it from a different way and say, I didn't think of that. So that's why it's a good idea to work through case studies like this in a group. In order to make that ethical decision, these are the steps that you should follow. Gather all the information that's necessary, that's available to you, on a particular situation that's going to help you make your decision. Consider the results of multiple actions. If we do X, what's going to result? Who's going to benefit? Who's going to be harmed? If we do Y, who's going to benefit? Who's going to be harmed? Is anybody going to be harmed? So consider what is the outcome of the various and assorted decisions or actions that you could take on each situation. Then identify what is your legal or ethical obligation. Do you have a legal role? Is there a fiduciary requirement? Is it purely ethical? And what is your ethical obligation? Go back to those 8 standards that INFRI has established and see if any of them fit. Consider your personal character and values. What can you live with? What can you, what's going to happen if you make a decision one way versus another? Will you lose sleep? Will you be concerned that if it gets published in the newspaper, for you acting in a certain way, that it could put you in a bad light? Those type of thoughts can raise red flags as to your ethical decision. You need to look within the entity that you're working with, the plan that you're working with, and see if there's any established policies or procedures for how the entity has said this should be done, what actions or what decisions need to make. And then finally, confirm with others if it's appropriate. Not all decisions it's going to be appropriate to look to somebody else to help you make it. But in general, that is going to be your best option to determine if you've thought of everything, if there are other things that you should have, maybe another way to look at it than you hadn't thought of. So confirming with others is the last step. So with the different case studies, I'm going to let you go ahead and go to the book and read through all of the different case studies that we have provided to you. But there is one. The first one is about a registered representative conducting a seminar in investment options, and the purpose for that situation, and what the counselor and representative should be doing in regard to any commissions that are associated with those investments, financial education program and why that's being developed and the costs associated. Case study 3 is a board member is looking for investment counseling, and there's information that's being disclosed that maybe and shouldn't be shared, and had the problem with that. A distribution from a 401k account and not maybe receiving sufficient information on what that distribution is going to mean to them, their actual final income in retirement, is case study 4. And case study 5 beneficiary form is being requested by a daughter for her mother who is a retired participant, and should the counselor provide that form to the individual? And we talked about that already briefly in regard to the situations that exist in regard to non-participant seeking information about a participant. Case study six. This is one that I just want to briefly go through with you, is in regard to a plan administrator who has worked through a hardship withdrawal application and determined that an applicant does not meet the requirements for a withdrawal, but then later finds out that the applicant that they are denying is a nephew of a board member, and the board member has asked for additional or consideration for the nephew. And then should the administrator actually do anything about the fact that there is a person in authority that is seeking perhaps additional or special treatment for a family member? You know, what's the ethical decision there? Is there any flexibility in what should the administrator do? So those are the six case studies that are in the textbook. And again, I encourage you to take time, go through those, work through them on your own, and hopefully you have one or two people that maybe you can work with and work through those together as well. So we've concluded this course by this webinar going through reporting, the role of independent professionals, and then talking about ethics for retirement administrators. And as a reminder, please complete the evaluation that will come up after the webinar and give us your feedback on this course. So with that, the webinar has concluded.